The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop.
Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 6 of War Notes, a conflict podcast. The title of this episode is Fixing Fight Club, Escalation, Dominance, and Salvo Competition. Fixing Fight Club is the series that I inaugurated when I started this adjacent podcast to my primary Chasing Ghosts podcast in a regular warfare conversation that I have to discuss how we can fix the U.S. and Western defense establishments, which find themselves confronting 21st century revolutions in military affairs for which they are very poorly prepared, they have not planned for this, and they are not reacting in a fashion that will make them effective as warfighting machines in the remainder of the century. In January of this year, 2024, episode 33, CG Excursion, Salvo Competitions, and the Big Fight, I laid down a lot of the groundwork for things that we're going to highlight and discuss today in this particular series. So if you wish to get more information and such, go back to that one and maybe you can reflect on that after you've listened to this, or vice versa. Some housekeeping. I'm releasing this episode just before Christmas, and the following weekend I will not be issuing another weekly episode of War Notes. That will continue, well, actually with the new year in 2025. Can you believe we are a quarter through the 21st century, and here we are. Haven't gone to space yet, haven't made ourselves an interplanetary race, and continue to war among ourselves as if it was 2000 BC, but there it is. I want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas, winter solstice, and happy holidays. I will be spending the next week with all of my children and all of my grandchildren in an undisclosed bunker location in the inland Rocky Mountain West. Much fun will be had. We plan on doing a lot of fun things, to include, of course, shooting, sports, wrestling, jujitsu, things like that. Really looking forward to spending that time, that quality time, with my sons and daughters and my grandchildren, of course. I will be there with my beloved bride. So I hope that everybody who is listening at this time is also either making plans or participating in those kind of holiday celebrations with family and friends. Again, happy holidays. If you wish to get in touch with me, as always, my email is cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. You will find that address in the show notes for this episode, and you will find this episode most likely on the podcast vendor of your choice. If it just so happens that I am not on a podcast vendor of your choice, please reach out to me and let me know so I can make that happen. So with that, let's get on with the episode. So I know of late I've been handling a lot of rather technical and some would say arcane and esoteric topic areas in my wholesale and comprehensive examination of what is wrong with the Western way of war and potentially offering solutions or at least effective means for us to address these shortcomings. But nonetheless, bear with me. In the show notes, of course, I will have references and book recommendations and such that I hope that if you're interested, if you wish to know more about it, you can find those resources. There is a certain linear logic in this Fixing Fight Club series that I put together where I'm sort of starting at the top, going across with broader topic areas, and I attend on addressing each of the individual services themselves and recommendations that I have for fixing those. When it comes to the topic today, escalation dominance is that's the nation's ability to control and dictate the pace and intensity of a conflict. especially when nuclear weapons are involved. As a matter of fact, in the last episode, I spoke in depth about how to handle the nuclear weapons crisis that is not only an existential threat to the planet, but by extension is one that is terribly problematic because of the sorry state of disrepair, age, and malpractice that's occurring in the U.S. and Western arsenals. In the context of nuclear deterrence, you know, it really becomes essential for a nation possessing these capabilities to have a clear and overwhelming advantage in terms of the scale and sophistication of its nuclear arsenal. And this superiority discourages potential adversaries from engaging in actions that might lead to a nuclear confrontation. It is a classic prisoner's dilemma where through mutual assured destruction, which has been like a sword of Damocles hanging over the head of the entire planet since the 1950s in the detonation of the first hydrogen device by the Russians, followed by other nation states that joined in the nuclear club, that this has caused calculations to go awry a bit. For instance, in the 1980s, clearly because of Warsaw Pact conventional advantages, the NATO nations adopted a first-use policy of nuclear weapons. When a first-use policy of nuclear weapons is adopted, there's no way to limit that war. There are all kinds of fantasists and analysts out there who think that maybe you can tactically employ nuclear weapons. And I'm talking about rational nation sets here. I'm not talking about terrorist use of nuclear weapons and things like that to start a chain of events that would lead to a global conflagration. What I'm talking about here is what is that calculus that goes into it? And that's what escalation dominance refers to. Escalation dominance isn't simply along the entire playing field involving only nuclear weapons, but when you're talking about first world nations that do have them, you have to put that into the calculation. Now, one aspect of escalation dominance is the possession of a diverse range of nuclear capabilities. For instance, in the U.S., you would have your silo-based munitions like the Minuteman III. You would have your submarine-launched ballistic missiles, the SLBMs, onboard SLBM submarines. And then, of course, you would have the bombs that would go on manned winged aircraft that would be used to violate the airspace of whatever their target state is and going in there and dropping these weapons. To me, especially in the 21st century, it seems to me that the use of manned aircraft is not only a question for combat aircraft at the tactical level, but also for bomber aircraft at the operational and strategic level. Strategic weapons tend to be designed for long-range attacks on major targets, while tactical weapons are intended for use in more localized conflicts or often of much lower yields. The combination of both types of weapons enhances a nation's flexibility and adaptability in responding to different threat scenarios, reinforcing its position of escalation dominance. All escalation dominance means in the end is that every level of increasing hostility, warfare, and intensity of combat, the forces that are employed, whether they've started the war or are responding to aggression, have the ability to dominate that. Now, one note here. During the 20th century, especially after World War II, for the most part, it was assumed after World War II that America had air supremacy. No one could dominate the skies like American air power. Then something occurred where it was called air superiority, which was a more localized version of supremacy by saying that over certain sections of the world, if it weren't a global concern, the air superiority, the dominance of American air power would be the primary source of that power in the area that was being contested. And then, of course, they escalated downwards. And then we have something called air dominance. And air dominance, when you look at it rhetorically and grammatically, seems to be saying that, well, we'll dominate, but we may not have the superiority and, of course, not the supremacy in there. And now what's happened with the opening of the 21st century, and I guess I've talked a lot about these revolutions in military affairs that I and other military and conflict observers have opined about, and that is that integrated air and missile defenses, what I've tried to talk about as 21st century variants on the use of artillery, and artillery, of course, is the Russian and I would say the Chinese center of gravity in the way they view the world, because as regional hegemons, and we're seeing this spread to other countries like Yemen, regional hegemons tend to be able to spend a lot more time on defensive armaments against projected power against their respective countries. Now, their integrated air and missile defenses have become extraordinarily sophisticated. As a matter of fact, as a small example, if we look at the conflict in the Ukraine and Russia, which has been going full throttle for over 2 years now, what we discover is that the Su-25 Frogfoot, which is the Russian variant of the A-10 close air support aircraft, doesn't see much airtime, isn't utilized very much at all, because these manned combat aircraft, and I think they are the first of a chain, can't be used effectively in near peer and peer conflict. And what we're seeing here between the Ukraine and the Russians is, I would say, suggest it's actually a peer conflict and not a near peer conflict. Near peer would be second and third tier nations that are fighting first tier nations that have considerable military armories, rich resources, lots of blood and treasure invested in what they can do. And these peer competitors, the U.S., China, Russia, tend to have the full spectrum of conflict tools available to them, whereas second-order nations and third-world nations and developing countries would not have that and would concentrate on what their strengths happen to be. For instance, the integrated air and missile defense used in an offensive fashion that has closed off the Red Sea on the southern coast, the southwestern coast of Yemen, since KSA, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and the U.S. and other interested parties started the conflict in 2016 to put down the revolt in Yemen against Sunni imperialism throughout the Middle East. So when it comes to escalation dominance and this complex realm of nuclear deterrence, that synergy between escalation dominance and claims of superiority and supremacy and such, you know, as nations navigate this intricate landscape of international relations, the imperative to invest in both military capabilities and these strategic communications that drive narrative, it becomes increasingly apparent that that's a big part of the Western arsenal. This symbiotic relationship between escalation dominance and narrative control underscores the multidimensional nature of effective deterrence. Now, mind you, I think this whole idea of deterrence has taken on a 21st century permutation that is distinctly different from that of the 20th century. Because during the 20th century, as I just briefly described, when it came to air supremacy being degraded down to air superiority, being degraded somewhat down to air dominance, and now the U.S. finds, as a result of what sober observers are seeing in the Ukraine, not even manned combat aircraft, the most sophisticated supposedly in the world, such as the F-35 and such, are not immune to being shot down by sophisticated anti-aircraft systems, whether passive acquisition or active acquisition. So I'm going to suggest that we add a new wrinkle to this whole notion of escalation dominance. I'm going to say that maybe there are rational actors in the international sphere for whom the exchange of nuclear weapons would be viewed as suboptimal for the entire planet. Now, can I say that that is the case in Russia or the United States or anything like that? I happen to think that the Russians are far better chess players than the U.S. and the West. I happen to think that they are much more sober in measuring the effects, and they tend not to play nuclear chicken in the same fashion as we have extraordinarily seen in the last 4 years with the special military operation in the Ukraine. Again, it always astonishes me that the U.S. and the West took their most sophisticated weapons systems, everything from the THAAD to the Patriot to the redoubtable Javelin anti-tank system, to manned tanks, from Leopards to British tanks to M1 Abrams, and they've seen them get destroyed. If anything, in the fall of 2020, in Nagorno-Karabakh, where Armenia and Azerbaijan fought themselves to a standstill, they discovered that robotics, UAVs, were a critical part of winning a conflict at the time. Whether that conflict ended in stalemate or defeat for either of the parties involved. Because what they discovered is that UAVs serve a number of purposes, among which are these. Number one, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance that is persistent. In other words, that can remain aloft. Maybe it's relieved by other craft that come and occupy the same space. And what they're doing is they're providing the detection, the cueing, and the target declarations to take things out, whether they are in the air or on the ground. Now, what I'm speaking to here is a persistent ISR capability that isn't weaponized, but is used as a third-party controller for incoming UAVs, UASs, unmanned combat modalities that are then vectored into what has been discovered and what has been detected and declared as a threat and neutralized. This has never happened before. It happened in a very short blush in Nagorno-Karabakh. But what we've seen now in this present conflict is that this is the new way of war, whether you welcome it or not. Presently, the Russians employ three generations of the Lancet, which has been used in concert with the Iranians as their premier, what's called affordable mass munition. It is a UAS that has doubled its payload from Lancet 1 to Lancet 3, and it has been shown to be able to take out tanks, infantry fighting vehicles, infantry fighting positions, being used to take down parts of buildings, all kinds of things. A complete revolution in military affairs. So here's what I'm suggesting. When it comes to escalation dominance, which has been a phraseology that has been employed when it comes to nuclear weapons, there has to be some analytical framework created to use escalation dominance, and you separate it from nuclear weapons, and we discussed that in the last episode if you're interested in a very specific and detailed overview of nuclear weapon systems planet-wide. Listen to the last episode in this War Notes series. But in this case, what I'm talking about is let's take the whole escalation dominance paradigm and apply it exclusively and with laser focus to the employment of robotic systems. And by extension, the employment of those robotic systems with autonomous targeting means. And in this case, what autonomous targeting means is no human in the loop. Because what's going to happen now, potentially, is that with hypervelocity munitions becoming the be-all and end-all of how warfare is going to be conducted successfully in this century, that munition will be in your lap if there's a human in the loop that makes the decision for cueing, detection, and then declaration that it is something to be fired upon. And by the time you are dealing with a hypersonic munition, the speeds that are in excess of Mach 5 will find that you don't have the ability to intercept it and service the target. So I think the whole escalation dominance process has to be isolated and focused on ISR wars, on UAV wars, on robotic wars, on autonomous targeting. Bundle all of those ideas together. And of course, we have to discuss hypervelocity munitions for both defense and offense. Bundle all of those things together in an analytical framework and, you know, task battle labs and advocacy tanks and forensics examination teams and operations research teams to examine this, war game it, models and simulation all of this so that we can come to a endpoint, a baseline, as it were, that will help us have the concepts and requirements that we need left of bang to design systems that are effective, because we don't have any in the U.S. or Western inventory as we speak. And it appears that when it comes to fire synchronization, for instance, the Russians have broken the code and the U.S. has not. When it comes to what the DoD fashionably calls affordable mass, which is part of that idea that we have to have things out there in proper quantity that we can employ to use to target the enemy's military assets. A quick explanatory sidebar. You have exquisite platforms, which would be aircraft carriers, capital ships, very expensive manned aircraft, whether bombers or fighters or transport aircraft or refueling aircraft, attritable, which may be manned, may not be manned, but it's something that you're expecting to take losses on, and of course, expendable. And expendable would probably be the affordable mass that I just talked about, where you have the sufficient quality and quantity of UAS, in this case, unmanned aerial vehicles and such. Or, and by the way, this is going to be ground combat vehicles that are unmanned, surface vehicles on the ocean that are unmanned, littoral, of course, undersea vehicles that are unmanned. The remainder of the 21st century will be a Manhattan-style, almost a space race to see what near-peer and peer nations can come up with these kind of modalities to more effectively win the wars that they will inevitably be involved in. So the very simplest ask is this: make a concerted effort to create an analytical framework, an explanatory framework that takes escalation dominance and confines it merely to the employment of unmanned combat vehicles from mud to near space, and what that's going to look like in a conflict in which you are actually fighting against those who have the same kind of assets. Of note, that will shock no one here, while the Lancets 1 through 3, those three generations of UAVs that the Russians have been so successfully employing in the special military operation in the Ukraine, cost around $50,000 or less. What it turns out to be in the U.S. and the West, in the U.S. in particular, when it comes to the acquisition system, is that they are placing the cost of each of these individual munitions and affordable mass at $200,000 to $300,000 per. Of course they are. And escalation dominance, of course, is rightfully so. It must be obsessed with salvo competition. And salvo competition is going to be in the clash, the collision between two near peer and peer complex adaptive systems, otherwise known as military and all their support systems. In war, you have the weights, as it were, of munitions that are available to throw at the other side, quite literally. Everything from small arms to aircraft sorties, to missile sorties, to defense against all of those things that are arrayed against each other. This is what salvo competition is about. Salvo competition is about that quantity and that quality of munitions. As Stalin famously said, that quantity has a quality all of its own, and we're noticing planet-wide that is very much the case, because while a lot of people disabuse themselves of thinking World War II or Korea or Vietnam or any of those could never happen again, well, lo and behold, it is exactly that way and happening all over again with a 21st century permutation of all those things that I preached about for the longest time. So I want to walk you through this real quick, and that's this. Precision guidance changed strike operations, because in the end, all wars and conflicts are about who can lob the most effectively with synchronized fires at the most targets to best the antagonist or antagonist block that they happen to be fighting at the time. Anybody who has listened to my bloviations in the past knows that I really enjoy having specificity in my language. So when I speak to precision and accuracy, there's two ways that scientists think about error. Accuracy refers to how close a measurement is to the true or accepted value, and precision refers to how close measurements of the same item are to each other. Precision is independent of accuracy. So by that, what I'm talking about is that we're going to talk about the precision of strikes, and I'm going to give you a quick tour down memory road from World War II to the present and what precision has done for guided munitions. And I would bifurcate this in this fashion. I would say that for the 20th century, it was manned aircraft and manned systems that provided the kind of advantages that near-peer and peer countries would have. The 21st century would give us a brand new variant on this, where unmanned systems would continue to escalate and dominate as far as how that precision guidance would deliver munitions to the target itself. In Germany in 1944, 1,000 bomber sorties, 9,000 weapons, which is 2.25 million pounds, on one target. Vietnam, 1970, 30 fighter sorties, 176 unguided bombs, that's 88,000 pounds, on one target. Iraq, 1991, one fighter sortie, two laser-guided bombs, 4,000 pounds, one or two targets. Iraq, 2003, one bomber sortie, 16 precision-guided munitions, 32,000 pounds, 16 tons, up to 16 targets. Now, today, let's call it 2022 for data purposes. One bomber sortie, 80 PGMs, 40,000 pounds, 20 tons, up to 80 targets. So you can see when it comes to that picture that I've just painted, a far lesser number of both manned and unmanned modalities are necessary to prosecute not only singleton targets, but multiple targets at the same time from a single platform. And as the 21st century progresses, this is going to get better and better because precision replaced mass fires. But I say that, but the Russians aren't quite convinced in that, which is why their artillery-centric warfare still considers mass to be an important part of prosecuting their wars. I want to draw a quick synopsis. I said Germany, 1944, 1,000 bomber sorties, one target, 9,000 weapons, in this case, 2 million pounds, a million tons of munitions. And then fast forward to today, one bomber sortie, not 1,000, 80 PGMs, 20 tons, not 2 million pounds, and up to 80 targets. Extraordinary. And think of that. What that is that's a 75-year interregnum, and that's how technology has moved forward. By the way, I'm drawing a lot of this information from Winning the Salvo Competition, Rebalancing America's Air and Missile Defenses. Now, this was published in 2016, and now we are on the verge of 2025 coming around the corner. I've looked to find better assessments of what's going on with this. So technically speaking, in the 10-year interregnum between today and the time that this was published, I think technology has changed, but I think a lot of the points made in this particularly brilliant article, well, this analysis that was put together, and I'll put this in the show notes, a lot of it still stands. A lot of this is still perfectly cognizant with what's happening today. And if only Gunziger and Clark, the two authors of this, could come up with something that examines this in light of the special military operations between Russia and the Ukraine, that would be very interesting. As you're aware, one of my watch phrases is Newton's third law is a stone-cold motherfracker. And because of that, what we find, as we have always found in the history of warfare, is that when advantages are discovered, then advantages and leverages against that warfighting mechanism are also going to be employed. And in this case, precision defenses are eroding the U.S. advantage when it comes to precision-guided munitions. The subtitle to this particular episode refers to wars of leakers. What a war of leakers is that when it comes to warfighting at the tactical and operational level, especially with the employment of missiles and masses of missiles and such, there's this concept called probability of kill, which I've touched on in the past. And what it means is that if you have incoming munitions, for instance, and you want to destroy those before they arrive at their target, what you've got to do is you have to send up more than one strike munition to service that target. As I've talked about with mid-course interceptors in previous episodes, if I have an incoming ICBM or IRBM when it reaches apogee and just before it tilts over to offload its single munition or its multiple independent reentry vehicles, which have a number of munitions on them, that bus has to be serviced before it tilts. If it doesn't, we have nothing in the inventory that can stop it. When we go to fire at that It is extraordinarily difficult, which is why, for the most part, 2 to 4 missiles are sent after one of these munitions to get the probability of kill above 90%. You can imagine how difficult this is if you just think about it. What you're doing is you cue on an ICBM or an IRBM that has lofted. You detect it. Then you go through a targeting methodology that the West has employed where you detect it, and then you have to make a declaration as to whether that is a neutral item, a friendly item, or a threat. If it's a threat, then you have to send something aloft to intercept it. And you have to be very specific in this interception, because what you're doing is you're trying to catch it at that one moment where it reaches its apogee, the height of its parabola, before it comes down, a parabola being a curve. Because once it, as I mentioned before, starts to tilt, that is the critical moment that it has to be serviced. Because once it tilts and then offloads that warhead or warheads, the acceleration becomes a solution set, a problem set for target interception that is almost impossible, yes, even now in the 21st century, to service that target with a single one and have the confidence that you will be able to intercept. Now, imagine a number of IRBMs and ICBMs are lofted, and then once they go aloft, let's suppose the number of MIRVs to make the numbers easy is 10, and 10 go up, that's 100 that are starting to tilt at either at the same time or at a different time, and those have to be serviced. Now, when it comes to integrated air and missile defense, there are two scenarios that are used for interception. One is called shoot, look, shoot. The other is called shoot, shoot, look. Shoot, shoot, look tends to use this probability of kill theorem that I just talked about, where you want to send 2 up instead of 1. Preferably, you'd want to send 4 up instead of 3. You know what they say, 3 is key, 2 is 1, and 1 is none. In this case, what you're trying to do is not only make sure that the math is correct for the interception, but what if something goes awry with one of your interceptor modalities? And you've only sent 1 up, that means you're going to miss, and this war of the leakers that I talked about is going to be even worse than you assumed. And by the way, remember that probability of kill that I dictated at above 90%? Maybe it doesn't even get to 100%. Maybe it's in that 10% time horizon for between the 90 and 100% where some of them aren't intercepted, which means that those leakers, those missiles that are not intercepted, are going to land either ballistically or through fin mixing and maneuvering at their target. Sometime in the future, I'll have to do an episode on the 1980s Strategic Defense Initiative, which I thought was one of those bright, shining lights in that America should be so proud of, that they were pursuing an actual defensive mechanism against nuclear warfare instead of a suicide pact, a mutual assured destruction, in which all those nations having nuclear weapons have signed on and said, if you launch, we launch, and we'll kill ourselves across the board in an existential fashion. For those of you unaware, when it comes to war in space, here we have a space force. When it comes to war in space, there's a whole lot of difficulties that are exo-atmospheric that don't occur in the atmosphere. You have these notions like natural space, which are all of those waves, radiation, and particulate matter that happens to be outside of Earth's atmosphere that has an effect on electronics, materials, and everything else that just so happens to go to those kind of excessive altitudes, and how it affects the efficacy and capability of these systems. It is very esoteric and very arcane, but something that has to be taken into account when designing these weapon systems, and also accounts for why these weapon systems are so extraordinarily expensive, not to mention what happens with orbital mechanics and space mechanics and how things are maneuvered in space. For instance, imagine, if you will, a zero-gravity scenario in which you have the International Space Station. You have the recent Boeing Starliner piece of crap that went up there and failed in such a spectacular fashion. Imagine what's involved in the docking of two things in a vacuum in space that are using spurts of energy to precisely align themselves so that they can couple together. There are people who spend their entire careers not only designing those spacecraft capabilities, but how those spacecraft can perform successfully that very difficult maneuver that I just described. So I just mentioned what's happening with precision defenses eroding U.S. advantage, and that continues apace, and we're seeing that. For instance, you have heard me complain about the fact that we take all of these weapon systems and send them to the Ukraine so that the Russians, who have really broken the code on fire synchronization, have been able to see in real time, real life, and actual operational experience what the training techniques and procedures are in employing these very sophisticated and expensive missile assets, from THAAD to Patriot and everything in between. And they have been taking notes, and they have discovered ways to obviate, obliterate, and neutralize these capabilities as a result of the West showing its hand by providing these weapon systems to Ukraine. So here's the dilemma, one of the dilemmas. I just articulated to you from 1945 to present time the reduction in the number of aircraft and the number of missiles or munitions that have to be employed to strike targets. But now what we're discovering is that there is going to be a need to increase salvo sizes because of the inevitability of systems that are employed to take out these precision systems that we just discussed. Some of the recommendations that have been played out is maximize the payloads using smaller PGMs. So what this would do by using smaller PGMs is then you would have an increased quantity and ubiquity of these, so that servicing those targets when they are inbound by the integrated air and missile defense systems of whatever the target country or area is, they would have more difficulty. And again, war of leakers. If you get anything out of this podcast episode, I want you to remember those three words, war of leakers. Some leakers will get through and inevitably neutralize or destroy the targets that they were sent against. Now, we've been discussing the SMO with Russia and the Ukraine. Now, let's shift to the Pacific real quick, where we have a very interesting salvo competition going on, which is that you have the regional hegemon of China with its second and third island chains starting to creep inexorably towards Western allies like Japan, Korea, the Philippines, and others that are in the area, not to mention U.S. territories like Guam and such, and the increasing radii, for instance, of their anti-ship missiles, or even their anti-aircraft missiles, and, by extension, their IRBMs and ICBMs. Remember, the Chinese are on their way past parity and maybe even achieving a superiority in the sheer number of nuclear weapons missile systems in the next 15 years, whether the West likes that or not. The West has a lot of catching up to do. And when I talked about nuclear deterrence and nuclear weapon systems in the previous episode, I had made mention of the Sentinel program that was designed to replace the 1970s era Minuteman III ICBM program and all the problems that it's having, consistently moving to the right with missile test acquisition problems and things like this. What is going to happen? My forecast is that the Chinese are going to continue to increase the multiplicity and the modalities that they're employing to loft both conventional and nuclear munitions, and they will outpace and outstrip the capability of the U.S. manufacturing base and the deployment options for the U.S. military in the next 15 years. And that strike advantage will, of course, take out what I consider to be the crossbow and the chariot of the 21st century, the American fascination and obsession with aircraft carriers and the accompanying aircraft carrier groups that are out there, which, again, I refer to those as future fish apartments. That's what they'll all be, at the expense of much blood and treasure and the tragic loss of thousands of lives. But it seems to me, for some reason or another, because the West, especially the U.S., is constantly fighting World War II, they take the assumption that they have confidence that these carrier battle groups will be invulnerable to any of these Chinese and also Russian threats to their capability. Let's keep in mind, you don't have to sink a carrier if you take out a shaft or put a 5-degree list to port or starboard on it, and it cannot launch aircraft. Aircraft carriers, as the name infers, have one capability, and that's launching and retrieving aircraft. By the way, the USS Ford can't do that very well at all. The newest class of U.S. aircraft carrier anachronisms to replace the redoubtable supercarriers in the Nimitz class. The bottom line is that when it comes to salvo competition, those with the most quantity combined with those with the most quality combined with those who happen to be regional hegemons instead of global hegemons because they've invested in defense capabilities that are both broad and in depth are the ones who are going to have the advantage whether they start the conflict or respond to a conflict that is thrust upon them by the U.S. or its allies. And look, it isn't simply Russia and China. Iran is punching well above its weight when it comes to the deployment of pretty sophisticated weapon systems. They have medium-range ballistic missiles in the Shahed class that have a range of up to 1,500 kilometers. I think there's even a Shahab 3 Bravo, and there's probably more, that are going to exceed 2,500 kilometers. They have an IRBM, the Musadin, 4,000 kilometers. They have SRBMs, those are short-range ballistic missile systems, with ranges of 300, 500. These are Shahab and Fatah and Tandar variants. Iran does get considerable assistance from Russia and China, but they seem to have an indigenous intellectual capacity for developing very sophisticated air modalities. And, of course, we've seen in the past year that Israel has seen some of this stuff up close and personal. Will Iran, by the way, be this singleton player when it comes to sophistication from a very small nation that is punching well above its weight? It is not. No, you have North Korea, which is a recognized nuclear capacity nation that has also, probably through very sophisticated coalitions with Russia and China and other peer countries, developed nuclear arsenals that are quite impressive for their size. When you look at Yemen, for instance, and what the Houthis have been doing. I am recording this morning a little bit before Christmas, and it appears that an FA-18, a Navy aviation aircraft, a fighter aircraft, has been shot down. Initially, that we were told it was shot down by one of our own ships in a fratricidal moment. My speculation was that most likely the Houthis had shot it down, and apparently the Houthis are coming out and taking credit for it. Who knows what the data will show us, but would I be surprised if the Houthis had managed to shoot down an FA-18? I would not at all. Back to China, let's remember that anti-ship missiles are important to them, but so are ICBMs. And when you look at their DF-4s and their 6 Alpha and their 31 and their 31 Alpha, and there's other variants that are coming out all the time, you have ranges in excess of 7,000 nautical miles. That's extraordinary. A possible PLA tactic will be first use of ballistic missiles to paralyze bases. Those bases would be in Japan, maybe like Okinawa, or maybe the naval bases on the main Japanese mainland. Maybe the refueling and logistics bases in Guam and places like that, and the bases in the Philippines and such. They have the capacity to do this, even if the integrated air and missile defenses there with Western forces like THAADs and Patriots and things like that. Again, war of the leakers. And what will be no surprise to anyone is that America and the West, by extension, of course, with NATO allies and even allies in the Pacific, has no real sophisticated mass integrated air and missile defense against all of these incoming munitions. So while I characterize a war of leakers, it might leave people with the impression that the West has these very sophisticated static and mobile defenses against incoming missiles, for instance, and that is not the case at all. I would suggest that while the Chinese can, in depth and across the expanse of their entire Pacific coastline, defend against incoming missile attack or manned aircraft attack. Let's say a tiny 10-plane strike package from one aircraft carrier is launched by the United States. I think that they would service that rather easily. And then what we have is this extraordinary situation where if we took every one of these, it could be a PAC-3 Patriot, it could be a GBI, it could be an SM-3, it could be a THAAD system, all of these systems, gather up every one of them that the United States fields and put them on the west coast of the United States, because all of a sudden there is chatter in crypto networks that China is planning on some kind of attack, that once that cross-strait invasion against Taiwan starts, they want to have some kind of attack laid in against the west coast at the same time. If you took all of those assets I just described, you would be lucky to defend San Diego County on the west coast, because you have neither the depth nor the expanse across the entire American west coast, much less, by the way, the Alaskan coast, to defend against those missiles coming in a seamless fashion. It simply isn't there, because for decades, if not ever since the end of World War II, that second D in Department of Defense has never been taken seriously by the Pentagon. Not only are the acquisition costs for all of these extraordinarily expensive for Singleton interceptors and such, and the technology that it takes to have that kind of interceptor capability, but also it's best suited for defeating a small number of rogue state or Singleton IRBMs or ICBMs that are sent in the direction of CONUS or Alaska or Hawaii. But the capacity simply isn't there to provide a comprehensive defense of the U.S. homeland. The authors that I alluded to earlier, for which I will provide their analyses in the show notes for this podcast episode, talked about a systems of systems approach is needed for this. There's no doubt that that's the case. A systems of systems approach has to be in place for everything that the DoD does. And if one looks at it from aloft, you think to yourself, well, they don't employ too many of those kind of approaches at all, because no single system will provide the lethality and the high capacity that's needed in this particular salvo competition problem set. We need new kinetic defenses and like medium range interceptors, artillery shells, projectiles that are relatively inexpensive, certainly not as inexpensive as a dumb round, but we can't spend $50,000 to $100,000 on a single round. When the abortive Zumwalt class destroyer came out, which has been an unmitigated disaster, the Lurlap weapons defense system for it, the single gun that it had the capacity to have in addition to its vertical launch systems, which held Tomahawks and SM munitions and such, it was $1 million a round. And they canceled it because it was $1 million a round. That simply doesn't make sense for an artillery system. It makes sense for a missile system because that's what they're designed to do. But for rapid gun systems and those kind of things, no, it doesn't make sense at all. The authors also suggested non-kinetic defenses like directed energy. This would be lasers, RF, microwave, electronic warfare, jammers, decoys, deceptions, things like that. That's great, but it's rather fratricidal if those are employed in close-in approaches. So that has its own problem set from a systems of systems perspective, where that fratricide has to be fixed. And then they also talked about battle management systems. And I think that those who have listened to me before have listened to me drone on and complain about the fact that when it comes to battle management systems, whether it is the air battle management system or JADC2 or a number of other modalities and things that are employed by the DoD, they're struggling. They're still at the starting blocks, and none of this has matured. While we see fire synchronization systems for the Chinese and the Russians, especially the Russians, mature and evolve in a fashion that is almost a sight to behold when it comes to watching what's been going on in the Ukraine and the maturity of fire synchronization there with the Russian strike fires reconnaissance complex. And I covered that in one of my previous episodes on Chasing Ghost when I did an excursion discussing that very thing. And thanks to my friend and colleague Les Grau for the pioneering work that he did in the 2010s on describing precisely what that was. The bottom line is interception of incoming IRBMs, ICBMs, operational missiles, missiles below 500 nautical miles in range, even at the tactical level below 50 nautical miles in range. The U.S. and the West has not invested in the sophisticated, deep, and high-density integrated air and missile defense systems for these en masse that they should have. This is a Manhattan Project for the Pentagon and the U.S. and the West in the 21st century, one of many, I would suggest, because when it comes to defense against hypervelocity munitions, this is certainly a preamble to making that happen in the future. We're not anywhere close to doing that. The two primary things that have to happen now is a complete recalibration, reconstitution, and sort of like a revision of the entire defensive array of the U.S. and West has to be made a priority. And also the synchronization of those fires, because you can't make an unlimited number of these projectiles. And as I mentioned before, if you haven't, and I urge you to do so, it's a short story by Arthur C. Clarke, written in 52 or 53 of the last century, called Superiority, where he talks about these two galactic empires and a science fiction story that are fighting against one another. One assumes that the most exquisite, expensive, and complex engineering modalities are what will win the war, while the brute force of the opposing empire is such that they think that quantity has a quality all of its own in a very Stalinist fashion. And in the end, it is a science fiction story after all. Who prevails? Well, it certainly isn't those who embraced exquisite weapon systems. It is time for America and the West to revisit the notion that defense is not a four-letter word. So, this is Bill signing off, hoping you have a great Christmas holiday, a great winter solstice, and I hope that this new year that's coming up, 2025, can you believe it? I mean, I was just, the other day I watched Stanley Kubrick's brilliant 2001 A Space Odyssey from 1968-69. Not only is it gorgeous cinematography, not only is it a compelling narrative, not only is it a tremendous screenplay, and the lensing is so beautiful, and it boasts one of the greatest soundtracks of all time. I thought to myself when I first saw that when I was 9 years old, wow, look what's just around the corner for me, because 1970 is there. And I thought in 31 years, it's going to look like this. Well, here we are 56 years past that point, and we're simply not there. By the way, if you get a chance to see 2001 A Space Odyssey or the companion feature 2010, I urge you to do so. Extraordinary filmmaking. A gentle reminder to all my listeners that a reason why I'm doing the Fighting Fight Club series and the reason that I inaugurated War Notes is that I think with the new administration that is coming in January of 2025, there may be an opportunity here to revisit and revision the Pentagon and war-making in America. And I'm offering through this series some hints, suggestions, and conceptual frameworks that will help the U.S. DOD get out of this mired, confused, and constantly at war mindset and take a knee and drink water and try to recalibrate and revision where we need to go and what we need to do to, number one, protect the homeland, number two, find a way to stop the endless wars, and number three, take this 20th century war machine, update it to the 21st century, and make it a force for good. This is Bill. I thank you for your solicitude. I urge you to leave reviews, mention to friends, family, colleagues, and acquaintances this podcast if you think that it would be interesting for them. And I thank you again. This is Bill, out.